This Sandwell News podcast is divided into chapters.
As we enter February, the days at last start getting a bit longer. Sunrise will be around 7:45, sunset at just before 5 p.m. Temperatures should be around 5 degrees Celsius.
Welcome to the final week's news from Sandwell News for the blind and visually impaired living in and around Sandwell for the last week of January. And available by post, which should be with you by the 31st of January, and on the internet and a podcast.
Some headlines from this week's readings from the Express and Star. Thursday, 2,000 e-bikes and e-scooters will hit the streets of the West Midlands from April. One in four children not toilet trained when starting school. The humiliating Hawthorne's horror show. Friday, Metro to Dudley opening very late. Mike Oldfield's Best of Tubular Bells hits the road. Peaky Blinders film The Immortal Man will have its premiere in Birmingham. Saturday, man charged with committing 15 offences after his week-long spree. Monday, postal delays, the real reason for late deliveries. Puppetry, dragons and canal songs in Smethwick Festival. Unions blame postal problems on lack of staff. Tuesday, being an active grandparent slows decline. Hospice support funding boost. On-duty trained security guard jailed for sexual assault.
Those stories and more courtesy of Express and Star publications. One or two disturbing things there. The spread of e-scooters and e-bikes, which are always an anxiety to blind and visually impaired people. And the postal situation. I don't know if anybody in West Bromwich, Tipton or Smethwick are having problems getting the Talking News on time. All the more reason, perhaps, that you might look to the internet or indeed our phone service if you don't get the news on time from us. Those, of course, are a couple of the stories coming up, and some news from SVI as well. That was the Busketeers, a charity fundraising outfit, part of which is Billy Speckmon, best known to you as a black country performer and storyteller, who's raising money for SVI. And there'll be a short piece about that later on in this week's news. But here to start with the first day's news.
This is James Brodie bringing to you stories from the Express and Star dated the 21st of January. Plans to relocate school into new £20 million building approved. Councillor project will transform one of the poorest sites into something space age. This story is brought to you by Christian Barnett. Plans to relocate an Oldbury school into a new £20 million building have been approved by councillors. Sandwell Council will build the new Causeway Green Primary School as part of the huge Brandall Village development in Oldbury, which will include 190 new homes and a 67-acre public park. The proposed new 420-pupil net zero school, which would be built on the former Brandall golf course, would replace the structurally failing Causeway Green Primary in nearby Penscrisic Lane, which is extremely poor condition and regularly flooded. The plans were backed by the Black Country's Authority Labour Cabinet at a meeting last Wednesday. At the meeting, Councillor Peter Hughes, Cabinet Member for Regeneration and Infrastructure, said that children at Causeway Green would be going from one of the poorest schools in the borough to something that was space age. The 70-year-old Oldbury School is in the worst condition within the maintained school estate and beyond its economic life. Due to the corrosion of steel frames, the Cabinet report said that its structural integrity was failing. Councillor Mohammed Jalal Uddin, Cabinet Minister of Children and Families, said that the £20 million work was Sandwell Council investing in the future. The new school would be leading edge and based on what are known as the passive house principles, meaning that it's energy efficient, cost-effective and supports our objective of being carbon neutral, he said. The rebuild and relocation is by far the most viable option for the school and the community it services. Councillor Udin added that the council was looking into whether the current school in Pencritic Lane could be reused once empty. Councillor Harnal Bullar, the Cabinet Member for Education, said that the new school would create positive impact for children and ensure the current poor building environment was replaced. The new school would be built on the former golf course near the corner of Grafton Road and Ferndale Road. The latest plans say work would start in the new school this autumn and would be finished by early 2028. A Cabinet report from November 2024 detailing funding for Brandall Village said the new school was expected to open in early 2027. Sandwell Council said that building a new school on a different site would be the most cost-effective solution. The local authority ruled out building a new school on the existing site, saying it would cost up to £5 million more. Building a new school to a passive house standard would cost £1 million more than a traditional design, the councillor said, but the associated lower running costs would eventually save the authority money. The council said that the school had been designed with greener features, which include using insulation, windows and ventilation to hugely reduce the building's energy demands and carbon footprint. The local authority originally looked into building 550 homes on the former Brandall golf course, but slashed its plans by two-thirds for fear of a backlash from campaigners. Charity run by military veteran receives life-saving £20,000 gift. This story is brought to you by Joanne Christie. A Wensbury-based charity supporting animals in areas affected by conflict has received a much-needed £19,569 donation from the prize draw company's Raffle House. An unexpectedly large donation was provided, enough funds for the Midlands charity War Paws to cover an entire month's running costs, as its Iraq dog shelter, which is set up 12 years ago, is to help the forgotten animals of war. The charity is run from Wensbury by its CEO, Louise Hasty, a military veteran who served in Iraq and spent a further 6 years living there after serving. She regularly travels from her home in the Midlands to oversee operations at the shelter, which provides permanent home for more than 100 local dogs. The centre also supports a further 800 dogs in the surrounding areas by neutering them and vaccinating them against rabies to protect the local population. The shelter employs 17 staff, including two veterinarians, who provide life-saving medical care for animals in need of 7 days a week. It relies largely on public donations to fund its work and receives no financial assistance from any government. 2 years ago, it set up a corporate partnership with Raffle House, a prize draw company that gives away multi-million pound homes and various other prizes. Part of its mission is to raise funds for charity, and with a portion of each entry going to a charity partner. When having tickets, Raffle House allows players to decide which of the charity partners they wish to direct the charitable donation portion of their entry to, and it distributes these funds to charities on an annual basis. In its first year, War Paws received a welcome donation of just over £2,500, but over the past year, the organisation has become more and more popular with players, and this year it received almost £20,000. When the email came through, you could have knocked me down with a feather, said Louise. Fundraising was particularly difficult for us in 2025, and I know charities across the board experienced the same thing. There has been a distinct change in people's giving habits due to the cost of living crisis, and so these funds really were life-saving in helping us to keep the shelter going. The money went towards vital resources such as vaccines, repairs, shipping supplies to Iraq, and staff costs. It costs us $22,000 to run the clinic every month, so the donation was more than enough to cover an entire month's costs. I'm very grateful to both Raffle House and its players for recognising the important work we do as a charity. James Melville, the executive director of Raffle House, said, "War Paws is something of an unsung hero, as it works, helps not only the vulnerable dogs of Iraq, but also the local people. It protects them against fatal endemic diseases such as rabies by providing crucial vaccinations for hundreds of stray dogs each year." Council's handed new powers to tackle pavements parking. The Department for Transport, that's the DFT, has confirmed that the new and improved legal powers will enable local authorities to restrict pavement parking across a much wider area than before. Under previous rules, authorities had to apply for pavement parking restrictions, often on a street-by-street basis, making their process slower. However, local authorities will now be able to decide where enforcement is most appropriate, allowing them to retain flexibility where they deem pavement parking may still be acceptable. Lillian Greenwood, the local transport minister, said, "Clear pavements are essential for people to move around safely and independently. Whether that be a parent with a pushchair, someone using a wheelchair, or a blind or partially sighted person. That's why we're giving local authorities the power to crack down on problem pavement parking, allowing more people to travel easily and safely and get to where they need to go." The DFT will set out guidelines on how local authorities will be able to use these powers in a proportionate and locally appropriate way later in the year. Andrew Lennox, the Guide Dogs chief executive, said that after years of campaigning, "We welcome the announcement to give councillors greater power to tackle problem pavement parking. Cars blocking pavements are a nuisance for everyone, but especially dangerous for people with sight loss who can be forced into the road with traffic they can't see. Pavement and parking is also a barrier that shuts people out of everyday life. When pavements are blocked, people with sight loss lose confidence, independence and freedom to travel safely. This stops people accessing work, education and social opportunities." Young lifeguards prepare for a national competition. This story is brought to you by Greg Rees. Sandwell Junior Lifeguards are training hard for the National Speed Lifesaving Championships in March 2026, after finishing 8th overall last year on their debut. Officially called the Speeds 26, it's the largest competition of its kind in the UK and will see 500 plus life-saving athletes and some 40 teams aged 12 plus from across the UK and Ireland competing for national titles in what is the only sport that has a humanitarian foundation. After well-attended introductory training events during the school holidays, the squad, made up of youngsters from the Core Wellness Facility in Tipton, Wensbury and Smethwick, are now meeting for 2 hours every Sunday at the renowned Sandwell Aquatic Centre and are preparing for different speed races. Each training event consists of two parts, the classroom elements focusing on the team building and communication skills, first aid and CPR plus water safety, whilst the pool element then concentrates on the competitive side of life-saving, mannequin toes, rope throws and using fins and torpedo buoys. Express and Star comment section. Anyone driving in parts of the West Midlands will know that it can be akin to the Wild West. In fact, many of us will have wondered aloud, how did he pass his driving test? According to evidence collated in a new report released today, there is every chance that the offending driver, and it is almost always a he, may in fact never have taken a driving test in his life. New official figures revealing that attempts to cheat driving tests in Britain increased by 47% in a year. This has naturally sparked concern about road safety, and it also begs the questions about the number of illegal drivers on the road and why more aren't being picked up or prosecuted. Some 2,844 cases were recorded in the year to the end of September 2025, according to the Driver and Vehicle Standards Agency. That's the DVSA figures. That is up from 1,940 during the previous 12 months and 1,274 in 2018/2019. The RAC Foundation said that driving test cheats are putting other road users at risk. Those taking shortcuts are failing to go through the proper learning process, and they are less likely to have any consideration for others out there on the roads. Cheating in the theory test includes the use of technology to get hold of answers. There have been hundreds of known cases of people impersonating others in practical tests. The presumption is that for those that are caught, many more get away with it. Driving standards on our roads have deteriorated in recent years. Much of it is down to impatience or pure selfishness, but some will be down to ignorance, quite literally. The driving test system must be amended, and those cheating the system and endangering others must be hunted down.
Hi, this is Debbie with some articles from the Express and Star from the 22nd of January. Deal will see over 2,000 new bikes and e-scooters hit streets by Gurdit Tandy. This article is accompanied by a colour photograph of a young woman in blue jeans and a black top riding an e-scooter in front of some office buildings. The caption reads, "Lyme has been chosen to run the bike and e-scooter hire schemes in the West Midlands from April the 1st. A new deal has been agreed which will see more than 2,000 new bikes and e-scooters hit the West Midlands streets from April. Transport for West Midlands, TFWM, has selected micro-mobility provider Lime to take on the management of the scheme following a competitive bidding process. The scheme will also operate at no cost to the taxpayer, bringing a saving of £1.4 million per year, the cost of running the cycle hire, to the authority. In October last year, TFWM granted a short-term extension to the contracts to enable a new provider to be found. Bosses said they wanted the new agreement, which comes into effect from April 1st, not to rely on public subsidy to keep the schemes going. Lime is introducing a new fare structure, but will maintain existing overall price levels for the first 2 years to make sure sustainable travel remains affordable. Both bikes and e-scooters will be available immediately after the launch on April 1st in the areas currently served, but councils, TFWM and Lime will work to grow the network. West Midlands Mayor Richard Parker said, "By bringing in a brand new fleet of bikes and scooters and freezing prices for the next 2 years, we're making sure there's a practical and affordable green alternative for shorter journeys, helping to tackle traffic congestion and improve the air we breathe. And by securing a partnership that operates at no cost to the taxpayer, we are saving the public purse more than £1 million a year. This is money we can now reinvest back into our regional transport, delivering better journeys for everyone." Full details of the new scheme are being finalised and will be announced along with the launch of a new app for customers closer to the start of the new service. Tom Newham, Lime Senior Manager of Public Affairs, said, "We're thrilled to be coming to the West Midlands and to be working with WMCA, whose ambition for active travel has laid strong foundations for expanding shared bikes and e-scooters across the region. The West Midlands is well suited and primed for this, with multiple towns and city centres close together and a strong public transport network. Through WMCA's continued investment in micro-mobility and supporting infrastructure, there's a real drive to make e-bikes and e-scooters a popular, practical and affordable choice for getting around." And Becky Marston, West Midlands Active Travel Commissioner, added, "This new partnership marks an exciting step forward for active travel. By significantly increasing the number of e-bikes across the region, we're making it easier for more people to choose a convenient, affordable and sustainable option for short journeys." Man is arrested following search. A man has been arrested after a quantity of Class A drugs hidden in an air fryer in Wednesbury was discovered. At around 8 p.m. on Tuesday, officers stopped a Nissan Juke on Walsall Street, Wednesbury, which was suspected to have been involved in the theft of a vehicle in Wolverhampton. A quantity of cannabis was recovered from the vehicle. During a search of an associated address, officers found Class A drugs hidden in an air fryer and a quantity of cash. A 22-year-old man was arrested on suspicion of driving while under the influence of drugs, possession of Class B drugs, theft of motor vehicle and possession with intent to supply Class A drugs. A police spokesperson said, "We are specifically working to identify criminals involved in serious organised crime and bring them to justice." One in four children not toilet trained when starting school. Youngsters are not being taught basic life skills at home, new report warns, by Jasmine Norden. Around one in four children in the West Midlands who started reception in 2025 were not toilet trained, a survey of teachers has found, amid warnings more children are struggling with basic life skills. In an annual survey of primary school staff by early years charity Kindred Squared, teachers estimated 26% of the children in the reception class this year were having frequent toilet mishaps, rising to over one in three in some more deprived areas. Kindred Squared is warning more and more children are arriving at the school gate without the basic life skills needed to engage with the curriculum. Staff also report around 28% of children started school unable to eat and drink independently, and 25% were struggling with basic life skills. It comes amid a government push to increase the proportion of children arriving in reception school ready, meaning they have hit certain developmental milestones such as basic language skills, being able to eat, go to the toilet and dress themselves independently, and being able to sit, play and listen. However, Kindred's survey of 1,000 primary staff found the estimated 37% of children are starting reception not school ready, up from 33% in 2024. Sharper drops in school readiness were reported by teachers in the West Midlands, along with the North East and North West. Staff estimated they are spending 1.4 hours a day changing nappies or helping children who are not toilet trained, and in total lost 2.4 hours teaching time a day due to pupils lacking basic skills. Kindred Square Chief Executive Felicity Gillespie said, "The state of school readiness has reached a critical moment, with 37% of children now arriving at the school gate without the basic life skills needed to engage with the curriculum. This is no longer just a classroom issue. It is a systemic crisis fuelled by stretched school resources, low expectations, the rising cost of living, and by parents who lack the right information and understanding early enough to truly support their children's development," she added. The government has set a target for 75% of children to be school ready by 2028. In the latest Department for Education figures, 67.7% of children were judged to have a good level of development by the end of reception in 23-24. Staff also reported that around 28% of children were not able to use books correctly. For example, they were trying to swipe or tap them like a phone or a tablet. Over half of staff said children's and parents' excessive screen times was a key factor in children not being ready for school. However, in a survey of 1,000 parents of 4- and 5-year-olds, 88% said their child was ready to start school this year, and more than 1 in 3 said their child was more ready than most children. Nearly all parents said they would like to see national guidance on making sure their child is school ready. Paul Whiteman of School Leaders Union NEHT said more support for early years children was crucial to tackle the issue. Thief who targeted supermarkets jailed. A prolific shop thief has been jailed for more than 8 months after targeting stores in Rowley Regis. Marcus Henry, aged 34, stole hundreds of pounds of items from two supermarkets in Rowley Regis between December the 26th and January the 6th. Henry also breached a criminal behaviour order, CBO, which was issued in May banning him from entering one of the supermarkets. Thanks to good quality CCTV, police were able to get clear images of Henry committing the crimes. Officers arrested him from his home address, and he was subsequently charged with 6 counts of theft from shops and breaching a criminal behaviour order. Henry, of Spiral Close, Hales Owen, appeared at Wolverhampton Magistrates Court and was sentenced to 36 weeks in prison. Sergeant Jason Walters from South Sandwell Retail Team said, "We understand the significant impact this crime has on local businesses, staff and the wider community, and recognise the harm it causes, not only financially, but also in terms of safety and confidence. This behaviour will not be tolerated, and we will continue to prosecute offenders and utilise the powers available to us in relation to civil and criminal orders. Please continue to report any suspicious activity to us so we can take action. You can do this by calling 101 or via live chat on our website. Always call 999 in an emergency." Sandwell has a dedicated retail team that focuses on bringing prolific offenders to justice. The team works closely with store security, retailers and partner agencies. The Debrief, a humiliating Hawthorne's horror show. This article is accompanied by 3 photographs. The largest has a picture of a football player in an Albion strip with one hand on his hip and his face in his other hand. And the caption reads, "Can't bear to look. Jason Malumbi reacts after Albion concede the 5th. The 2 other pictures, one has a man in a black tracksuit walking across the field, and the caption reads, "Eric Ramsey trudges off." The other picture shows a footballer kicking a ball, and the caption reads, "Samuel Ling Jr. was least bad." Albion 0, Norwich 5, by Lewis Cox. It was nothing short of a total Hawthorn's humiliation. Norwich City cantered to a 5-0 thumping of Albion to leave Eric Ramsey's hapless hosts battered and bruised, and in a very real relegation scrap to avoid the third tier ahead. Here is the latest debrief. Worst ever. No Albion fans of a certain vintage need telling about bad days at the Hawthorns, but Tuesday night tops the lot. It is officially the club's worst ever home defeat outside of the top flight. More unwanted club records. In the Great Shine's 125th year. Embarrassing. Crewe 1999, Swindon 1995, Plymouth 1993, Newcastle 1989. There have been some shockers a generation or two ago, but nothing tops this. The second half capitulation, in which Norwich struck four unanswered goals, was a total and utter collapse. It looked as if the players had thrown in the towel. That too after a first half that Ramsey claimed to have shocked him. Enough for the head coach to make a triple half-time substitution and send his players back out after some short shrift. Next up is Pride Park tomorrow night, where Albion have not won since 2003. 10 straight-away league defeats. It could get worse. Penny for Shillin's thoughts. The chairman told us at Ramsey's media unveiling just 7 days ago that even from thousands of miles away at their Tampa home, he feels every gut punch delivered against his club. He and his fellow Bilkul team certainly would have felt every ounce of that pain against the Canaries. Patel, who was at the ground, will have heard every boo and every syllable of "you're not fit to wear the shirt," a damning and perfectly fair jibe aimed at the blue and white stripes from the home fans. The Hawthorns was nervous all night, even before a ball was kicked and at 0-0. It was a huge night, a six-pointer. It was understandably half-empty at full-time, but the jeers were still piercing. Square pegs. Ramsey's 3-4-3 wing-back system has been debated and scrutinised after two games. The phrase square pegs and round holes has been used. That is a stretch to a point because the new head coach has yet to have any midfielders available to start a game, and it shows. But Mikey Johnston and Isaac Price, Albion's best attackers, have now started at right wing-back. Both experiments have gone disastrously. Charlie Taylor, the veteran lone left-back, is not working in a back three. But the natural centre-backs have fared just as badly. Against Norwich, Carlin Grant led the line as the most advanced with Josh Maya, in for Owen Hegebo, in support to the right. It worked for neither man. The only player suited so far is Samuel Illing Jr. at left wing-back. It may be Ramsey's way, and if that is the case, then he may not look to change it. But it does not appear Albion have the players to fit it.
This is Lauren with some stories from the Express and Star from the 23rd of January. Metro opening runs very late. Written by Martin Smith, local Democracy reporter. First 2024, then last autumn, then New Year, and now the end of August. The Midlands Metro tramline will open for passengers in Dudley at the end of August, more than 2 years late. The line was supposed to launch in 2024, a date that was put back until autumn last year. That date was again delayed to early this year, and now a new deadline of August 28th has been given. The delays will frustrate passengers and anger businesses who say they have been impacted by the Metro works. At a meeting of Dudley Council's Communities and Growth Scrutiny Committee, council leaders faced questions on what help was available for traders affected by the delayed works. Councillor Steve Edwards wanted to know what was being done to support struggling businesses in Dudley Town Centre whilst they waited for the line, linking the town to Wednesbury to be finished. Dudley Council's leader, Councillor Patrick Harley, said, "The constant delays are unacceptable. We now have a definitive date for when the Metro will be up and running, August 28th. The line into Dudley was originally planned to open in 2024, before work began on a second phase to take the line to Merry Hill, and, when funding was obtained, into Brierley Hill Town Centre. Increased costs caused further delays to the project, which is managed by Transport for West Midlands, part of West Midlands Combined Authority WMCA. Construction of Phase 1 into Dudley should be complete this spring, but the line will not open to passengers until drivers have been trained. In the meantime, Dudley's leaders have been in talks with the WMCA and West Midlands Mayor Richard Parker to negotiate help for town centre businesses." Councillor Harley said, "The Mayor is very proactive looking at how we can try and offer compensation to some of those businesses affected. We can't offer compensation to them all, but the CA are looking at that to date some, about half a dozen businesses, particularly around Birdcage Walk. Some of them have received in excess of £100,000. There are schemes out there helping businesses, but with added delays, we need to do more. Councillor Edwards said, "That's still 8 months. Businesses have closed in the last few months based on the negative impact, and we could get to August with even fewer shops." Alongside this article is an artist's impression of the new metro. It is at Dudley Zoo and Castle, so the background is completely green, full of trees. There is a metro stop with a big sign saying Dudley Zoo and Castle. The metro itself is made up of five carriages, grey with pink stripes along the side, running along some tracks. Captioned, "Artist impression of the Midland Metro extension to Briley Hill via Dudley and passing Dudley Zoo and Castle." Man arrested after threat made to staff in armed robbery. A man has been arrested on suspicion of a number of offences in connection with an armed robbery at a bank in the Black Country. West Midlands Police said the incident had taken place on Tuesday on Bearwood Road, Smethwick, with a person entering the bank with a weapon and threatening staff, then stealing an iPad. The force confirmed a 45-year-old man had been arrested on Wednesday on suspicion of robbery, as well as a number of other offences relating to incidents in Birmingham and Sandwell. A police spokesman said, "Officers arrested a 45-year-old man on suspicion of robbery. He was also further arrested on suspicion of a number of offences. The man remains in custody for questioning." Mike Oldfield's Best of Tubular Bells Hits Road, written by David Banner. Following the acclaimed 50th anniversary tour, the Best of Tubular Bells celebrates musical pioneer Mike Oldfield's iconic work on a UK tour. It follows the hugely successful extended 50th anniversary celebrations of Oldfield's Tubular Bells, which toured throughout the UK, Europe, Australia and New Zealand in 2023 and 24. Now, the Best of Tubular Bells 1, 2 and 3, which celebrates the brilliance of these iconic and seminal musical pieces, will tour across the UK throughout February and March, including a show at the Alexander Theatre in Birmingham on February 8th. Tickets are available from Ticketmaster. One of the most pioneering and influential musicians of all time, Mike Oldfield's visionary Tubular Bells series spans three albums and 17 years, with Tubular Bells created in 1971 and released in 73, Tubular Bells 2 released in 1992, and Tubular Bells 3 released in 1998. With each album, Oldfield expands on the themes and theatrical variations he first composed at aged 17, continually innovating and pushing boundaries. The Best of Tubular Bells 1, 2 and 3 28-date UK tour will feature an expansive live group led and arranged by Oldfield's long-term collaborator, Robin Smith. There will be the whole of Tubular Bells 1 performed in full, along with extended sections of Tubular Bells 2 and 3, as well as the worldwide hit single Moonlight Shadow. Tubular Bells, created in 1971 and released in 73, was the debut studio album by English multi-instrumentalist composer. Oldfield recorded and played almost all the instruments on the album, gained worldwide recognition when the opening theme was used for the soundtrack of the horror film The Exorcist, and went on to become the highest-selling instrumental album of all time. A bold and progressive fusion, Tubular Bells is a journey through classical, jazz, folk, progressive rock and electronica, and went on to win a Grammy for Best Instrumental Composition in 1974. Tubular Bells 2 was released in 1992, and, like its predecessor, charted at number one in the UK Albums Chart. Featuring the top 10 single, Sentinel, Tubular Bells went double platinum in the UK. The third instalment in the Tubular Bells series was released in 1998 and draws on inspiration from the electronic music popular in bars and clubs in Ibiza, where Oldfield moved to in 1996. Collaborator Smith, the Grammy-nominated musical director of the tour show, was completely mesmerised by Tubular Bells the moment he heard it. He studied composition at the Royal College of Music, spent several years touring the world as a piano player, and was the principal pianist of the National Youth Jazz Orchestra. Smith has collaborated with Oldfield for more than three decades, with performances at iconic locations such as Edinburgh Castle, Horse Guards Parade, and the 2012 Olympic Games opening ceremony. Of the tour, Smith says, "All of these epic works are filled with music of the utmost creativity and continually take the listener on extraordinary journeys of imagination." Alongside this article is a picture of Oldfield's work on tour. The stage is black with a big black backdrop. In the back is an expansive drum kit. I couldn't even begin to name all the different kinds of drums there are. There are bells, tubular bells, of course, long glass cylinders hanging from bars. There are three people stood at the front of the stage. Starting on the left, a man with curly hair, a black blazer, black trousers and a yellow top playing the acoustic guitar. In the centre is a lead singer. She has long blonde hair, a beautiful flowy skirt and an equally beautiful cropped long sleeve top. She has her arms in the air and seems to be singing. And on the far right of the picture is a man in a patterned shirt, glasses, black jeans and trainers playing the electric guitar. All over the stage, I can see four different guitars, wires, amps, any kind of instrument, and it's there. Captioned, "The celebration of Mike Oldfield's work will be on tour from February." Shelby's Coming Home by order of the Peaky Blinders. Second city to host film's world premiere with most of movie shot in the region. Written by Fionnuala Bourke. The Peaky Blinders film, The Immortal Man, will hold its world premiere in Birmingham, with most of the movie being shot around the West Midlands. The announcement has been made on the official Peaky Blinders Instagram page for the iconic gangster drama series, which is being shown in selected cinemas from March 6th and streaming on Netflix on March 20th. No exact date has been released for the Birmingham world premiere or location at present. Much of the film was set in the West Midlands, with its creator Stephen Knight opening his film Digbeth Lock Studios in Birmingham. Scenes from the movie were filmed by the canal at Bumble Hole Nature Reserve in the Netherton area of Dudley. It has also been claimed that a location spotter is looking for sites around Wolverhampton for the next series. There is much excitement about the new feature-length format of the gangster series, which will see more exciting action from crime boss Tommy Shelby, played by Cillian Murphy. The official description for the film states, Birmingham, 1940. Amidst the chaos of World War II, Tommy Shelby is driven back from a self-imposed exile to face his most destructive reckoning yet. With the future of the family and the country at stake, Tommy must face his own demons and choose whether to confront his legacy or burn it to the ground. Alongside Murphy, the film cast includes Rebecca Ferguson, Academy Award nominee Tim Roth, and Sophie Rundle. The production will also feature Oscar nominee Barry Keoghan and recent Golden Globe winner Stephen Graham. Peaky Blinders creator Stephen Knight wrote the screenplay for The Immortal Man, with Tom Harper directing. Creator Stephen Knight said, "The Shelbys are coming home and you are invited to join us by order of the Peaky Blinders." Alongside this article is a picture of Cillian Murphy, who's playing Thomas Shelby, and Stephen Knight, the creator of Peaky Blinders. Cillian Murphy is sat on the left, Stephen Knight on the right, both in high up director style chairs. Cillian Murphy wears a black beanie, a dark grey coat and a black hoodie, while Stephen Knight wears a blue trench coat and a blue polo shirt. both are sat smiling at the camera. It's captioned, "Crime boss Tommy Shelby, played by Cillian Murphy, with Peaky Blinders creator Stephen Knight."
Hello, this is Sarbjit with your news from the Express and Star, dated Saturday the 24th of January. Drug suspect is held after chase. Police arrested a suspected drug dealer following a foot chase in the Black Country. The suspect has now been bailed. Whilst on patrol on Tuesday evening, West Midlands police officers say they spotted a man acting suspiciously beside a vehicle on Roman Way, West Bromwich. Following a foot chase, the suspect was detained and searched. A quantity of cash and bags of cannabis were recovered. The force said a 26-year-old man has been arrested on suspicion of possession with intent to supply Class A drugs. They added he had been placed on bail pending further inquiries. A spokesman urged anyone spotting any suspicious activity to contact the police on its non-emergency number. If you see any suspicious activity in your area, call 101. Always call 999 in an emergency, the spokesman said. Man is charged with multiple offences during week-long spree. West Midlands police have charged a man with committing a number of offences across both Birmingham and Sandwell. Anthony Mullen, aged 45, from Birmingham, has been charged with 16 offences. The allegations include aggravated burglary, fraud, theft of a motor vehicle, burglary and possession of an imitation firearm. It comes after a series of incidents in Sandwell and Birmingham that have been reported since last Monday, where addresses and businesses were broken into, police confirmed. The crime spree concluded with a robbery at a bank on Bearwood Road, Smethwick, on Tuesday, where an iPad was stolen and staff members were threatened. Mullen was remanded into police custody to appear at Birmingham Magistrates Court yesterday. A force spokesman yesterday said, "Anthony Mullen, aged 45 from Birmingham, has been charged with 16 offences, including aggravated burglary, fraud, robbery, theft of a motor vehicle, burglary and possession of an imitation firearm." This comes after a series of incidents in Sandwell and Birmingham since last Monday, January 12, where addresses and businesses have been broken into. Officers added, "Reducing robbery offences is one of our priorities, and we are running Operation Ruby to tackle those committing crime, while working to spread crime prevention messaging across the region, so people can keep themselves and their belongings safe." New Hub offers music studio, mechanics workshop and gym. We're a community project and community is everyone. We're stronger together. By Dan Stacey. There is a picture of the new facility in Wensbury, which also houses a mechanics workshop. Picture of a group of people. She Beasts is a female-led organisation founded to empower people. A new community hub has opened in Sandwell with a music studio, a gym with special boxing and bodyweight exercises, and a mechanics workshop. She Beasts CIC is a female-led organisation founded with a mission to empower people from all walks of life, offering support and guidance as they climb their personal and professional ladders. The new hub on Brunswick Park Road in Wensbury offers a range of classes and memberships within their new gym space, including specialist boxing training, trampoline work and body weight exercises, while the facility also houses a mechanics workshop, a music studio, and a large communal area. The space is really centred around the She Beasts mission and ethos, which is transform, empower, employ. Sadie Jones, founder of She Beasts, explained, "We've got a number of rooms dedicated to different streams, and it's about welcoming the community into the space and educating people. We run a number of classes in the gym as well as offering memberships. We've got a mechanics workshop where we offer apprenticeships and give people the chance to get actual qualifications and jobs in that industry. And then we also have a music studio which offers something really similar too. The heart of our space is still a work in progress. Our community room will bring people together and will be somewhere that you can just come and be yourself, connect with others and get to know people a bit better." Sadie, who has a background in bodybuilding, personal training and human capital management, began the project alongside her partner, Moisha Shepherd, a music artist and entrepreneur better known as Big Stigs. And the pair intend to use their industry connections to provide the best possible environment to work and learn in. "We'll be leaning on our networks, and there will be different artists that come in and mentor," Sadie said. "We've already had Mist as part of this first program, and we've had some young people in making music as part of our launch. A lot of the women who we've helped through our workshops have actually gone on to become part of the team. So they'll be coaching and delivering classes. And then we have a lot of referrals coming from probation services, women's refuges and women's prisons. Now that we've created an allyship in conjunction with my partner, we'll be able to see a very similar format for young boys and for men. And our project only really works when the outside community engages with us. Whether it's becoming a gym member here, using our music studio, getting your motorbike or quad bike repaired here rather than elsewhere, that income is what we are then able to reinvest into the communities that we serve." The She Beasts organisation celebrated its fifth birthday shortly days before the launch of their new community hub. And Sadie revealed things that only gone from strength to strength for her organisation over the years. "It hasn't gone as I first expected," she admitted. "When it started, I thought it was going to be a small group of women that I would support within my immediate community. I started it because I am the original She Beast. I've been through many of the things that we support. I've been in children's homes and I've been in women's refuges. What started out as just working with women then became working with young people, and that developed into us focusing on prevention rather than cure. Last year we started working with young boys and formed partnerships with Mankind, and now the aim is to become even bigger and better. Really, we are what we say on the tin. We're a community project and community is everyone. We're stronger together." Ray of hope as Lords back under-16s social media ban by Dan Morris. Finally, some sense is being talked. A UK social media ban for under-16s is on the cards. In the wake of the recent Grok outrage, where X's in-house AI has allowed sexualized images of real women and children to be created, the House of Lords has backed a ban on under-16s using social media. The red benches have passed an amendment to the government's Children's Wellbeing and Schools Bill, which is currently making its way through Parliament. The House of Commons, of course, has the chance to overturn this. Yet, with the government under pressure from opposition parties, as well as Labour backbenchers, such a move is looking increasingly unlikely. This is fantastic news for our country and our children. When news of Australia's intention to institute such a ban hit the headlines, I prayed that the UK and other countries would follow suit. Australia's ban came into force in December, and we look set to be the next country to put the welfare of our young people first and make a strong but necessary move in the fight to shield them from online abuse. For decades, social media has been used in many positive ways, linking people up with far-flung friends and family, and serving as a tool for the building of new relationships. Unfortunately, it has also been a facilitator for bullying, intimidation, and sexual abuse. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. If one child has suffered psychological damage at the hands of the dregs of society wielding social media as a weapon, then the price is simply too high. It seems that those in power may finally be about to take firm action, and as a father, I am nothing less than elated. At only 3 years old, my daughter is currently blissfully unaware of social media, and regardless of the government's decision, any conversations with her about it will not take place for a long time. My greatest hope, however, is that they never need to take place at all. And by the time she is of age to use it, it is a distant memory for most of us and something teens have long learned to live without. The question is, what will the world for UK youngsters look like without social media? In a word, I suspect, better. Regardless of documented instances of abhorrent abuse, in recent years I have heard countless horror stories of children and teens showing less and less interest in the real world and becoming absorbed in the online sphere to the point of addiction. Tales of the bedroom door closing on a Friday evening and not to be opened until a Monday morning have been unnervingly common, with said youngsters spending their entire weekend interacting with others only through online portals. This is unhealthy and flat out wrong, yet for mums and dads, it is an incredibly difficult cycle to break. Nobody wants to be the one parent who insists their child can't do the same thing as other kids. Happily, if an outright ban is brought in, this won't have to be the case. All youngsters will be forced to ditch the digital world and get back to the real one, and to be actually social rather than glued to a smartphone or keyboard. When I was a kid, cue Hovis theme tune, being outdoors was the default setting, with social time with other children having been spent cycling, rollerblading, tree climbing and making up games. There was no other way to socialise outside of school. Technology was yet to make this easier. These were the better days, and I shudder to think what might have become of my character had I had the option of connecting with others without leaving my bedroom. Because such connection isn't real and is missing so much of the vital stuff that is being physically face-to-face with your peers brings in terms of social development, confidence, empathy and respect being at the top of the three. If someone had introduced me to the worlds of social media and online gaming when I was a youngster, I'd have lapped them up with both hands. And I suspect that now I would be worse off for having done so. Fingers crossed that a UK ban on social media for under 16s does come into place, and that those young people who can't comprehend a world without it quickly learn how beautiful and happy such a world can be. It's time to get back to reality. Warning issued to fans after pickup truck stolen. Police have issued a warning to football fans to make sure they park their vehicles in safe and well-lit areas during the evening after a Nissan Navara pickup truck was taken during a West Bromwich Albion game. The vehicle was taken from Park Lane Industrial Estate, West Bromwich, close to the Hawthorns on Friday night, January 16, when the owner was in the stadium watching the game against Middlesbrough. The owner, who didn't want to be named, contacted the Express and Star to say the truck had been taken along with football-related items in the back worth £150, including cones, balls and a portable goal net. He said it would affect the running of a youth football team based in Rushall and also stop him from getting to work in Somerset, where he is a contractor. Police are appealing for information and said, "We are investigating after a vehicle was stolen from Park Lane Industrial Estate, West Bromwich, on the evening of 16 January. We take this type of crime extremely seriously, as we don't underestimate the impact it has on vehicle owners. Anyone with any information is asked to call 101, quoting 20/116029/26. Where possible, we'd advise drivers to park in safe and well-lit areas.
Hello, this is Jenny. The following articles are from the Express and Star newspaper dated Monday, January 26th. Parcels before letters policy blamed for our post turning up late. First class deliveries are supposed to arrive the day after they are sent, but men report having nothing for weeks. An article by Mark Andrews. Where has our mail gone? We have always had a good moan about the Royal Mail, but the current state of our delivery service has become a real problem for many and a major talking point in the West Midlands. There is one valid excuse. Mail has been delayed in a total of 68 postcode areas across the West Midlands this week, with Royal Mail blaming a backlog caused by recent snow. There have been reports of problems in Shifnal, Wolverhampton, Dudley, Telford and Newport, by no means an exhaustive list, with significant numbers of residents saying they have not received any mail since Christmas. But is it really all down to the weather? We have had a few days of snow, certainly, but nothing on the scale of the infamous winters of 1947, 1963, 1982 or even 2010 and 2011, where the post still managed to get through. Something fundamental appears to have shifted in the Royal Mail. Sending a letter is one thing, when it is delivered is another. And if you are waiting for a hospital appointment, the implications of a letter arrival can be serious. When Sean Davies, MP for Telford, recently raised the matter in the House of Commons, he reported an anecdote which has become increasingly familiar in recent weeks. Posties have contacted me privately to tell me they have been ordered not to deliver post and to prioritise parcels, he told fellow MPs. Sir Alan Campbell, leader of the House of Commons, replied that he had heard exactly the same rumour this week. These stories are also rife on the streets of the West Midlands. A man from Dudley, who had asked not to be named, said his own postman said he was under instruction to prioritise parcel deliveries over letters. He told me that some of the letters he was delivering had been sat on for 3 weeks, he said. In October last year, Royal Mail was fined £21 million by regulator Ofcom for failing to meet its targets for first and second class mail. It was the third consecutive year the operator had been fined for its poor performance. And in the past week, both Mr Davies and Mark Pritchard, his neighbouring MP for the Wrekin, have lodged separate complaints with Ofcom. So what is going wrong with the service? A Royal Mail spokeswoman, who declined to be named, denied that the postal workers were being instructed to cut back on delivering letters and to instead focus on the more lucrative parcel side of the business. Ofcom has looked into this claim previously and found no evidence that Royal Mail instructs the prioritisation of parcels over letters outside of those recognised contingency plans, she says. It is important to understand, with those who say they go days, even weeks with no letters, only for them to appear bundled together with an elastic band. Mike Wood, MP for King's Winford and South Staffordshire, previously Dudley South, says the problem is far from a new phenomenon, having received a total of 22 complaints over the past 3 years. I'm seriously concerned that people in King's Wynford have not been receiving letters on time via Royal Mail, with posts sometimes taking up to 2 weeks to arrive, he says. I have also raised similar issues of poor service in Pattingham, Kingswood and Womburn. This is a long-standing and repeating issue, and although things initially did seem to be improving early last year, complaints about the service have increased once again over the past 6 months. Mr. Wood cites an example of a woman being pressured by her energy supplier after failing to pay a bill she had not received. A neighbour had exactly the same experience, he says. Another resident complained that a letter from Russell's Hall Hospital took 12 days to arrive. In July last year, a constituent reported going 2 months without any mail, despite having been sent letters by first-class post in May and June. The same month, two constituents complained of missing hospital appointments, the one receiving no post for 5 days, the other for 2 weeks. Neighbours went to the sorting office to complain but were dismissed on staffing grounds, he says. On another occasion, a constituent received no mail for 3 weeks before it all arrived bundled together. I've written to the director of Royal Mail multiple times regarding the King's Wynford sorting office, but the service just isn't improving, says Mr. Wood. I am yet to receive a response that addresses the problem in full. In July last year, Ofcom agreed to relax some of the rules laid down in its universal service obligation, after the company argued that the requirements were no longer sustainable in the long term. Most affected was the second-class service, which shifted from Monday to Saturday service to one with deliveries just 3 days a week, Mondays, Wednesdays and Fridays. Delivery targets were also relaxed, with the required number of letters delivered the next day cut from 93% to 90%. For second class, the targeted level of post delivered within 3 days was reduced from 98.5% to 95%, although a new requirement was added that 99% of all mail must arrive no more than 2 days late. The delays in the post impacts people in many ways. Pensioner Michael Thicket of Penn Wolverhampton subscribes to the Radio Times and has it sent to his home. But the 79-year-old has been getting them up to a fortnight late, which means they come after the programmes have been aired. He said, "It is incredibly frustrating. Two came on the same day, one was a fortnight late and the other a week late. I pay a lot of money for the subscription and they are sent first class. The Royal Mail tells us that first class post should arrive the day after it's posted, but the service has turned into a complete shambles." Businesses like the Radio Times, who rely on the post to send out subscriptions, must be tearing their hair out and losing valuable business as people simply cancel. Royal Mail has published a list of 68 areas of the West Midlands where it says postal services have been disrupted by the recent bad weather. It says many of the delays are down to bad weather, although our MPs say they've been getting complaints for many months. Mark Pritchard, MP for the Wrekin, has lodged an official complaint with the regulator Ofcom, and Sean Davies, MP for neighbouring Telford, said postal workers had told him they were being instructed to prioritise letters over parcels. Last year, Royal Mail was fined £21 million for missing its first and second class post requirements. Royal Mail says recent adverse weather conditions have affected deliveries in 68 postcode areas across the West Midlands. Those affected in Sandwell are Smethwick B66 and B67, Tipton DY4, Wensbury WS10 and West Bromwich B70 and B71. While customers accept that the snow caused problems, they say their erratic post dates well back before the region suffered from the cold snap. One King's Wynford resident who did not want to be named said she gets nothing for weeks and then a bundle arrives. She said, "This seems to be the norm now. We've had about 30 letters dated in December, delivered on January the 19th. Leslie Jones from Sedgley received 14 letters on Wednesday, January the 21st, One was dated December 29th and a hospital appointment for January the 8th, she said. It's disgraceful. Leah Williams from the West Midlands says her water bill took 5 weeks to arrive, meaning she was overdue with her payment and had to settle the bill in full because she was not eligible for monthly payments. Royal Mail as a company left me in a bit of a tight stretch, and I'm sure this is the case with a lot of people when receiving bills. Joanne Tallis received 15 letters on January the 22nd, including one from hospital, dated December the 5th. Something has gone very wrong with Royal Mail, she says. Puppets, dragons and canal songs for the return of Fun Festival. An article by Helen Stallard, your world contributor. Experience dragons in the woods, songs from the canal, puppet shows for the kids and the magic of cranky storytelling as a popular festival returns for half term. Smethwick Puppetry Festival returns this February half term with a packed programme that includes dragons in Morley Woods, puppet shows, music inspired by the canals and an exhibition of cranky storytelling devices. The festival, which will run during half term from February the 14th to the 22nd, we'll see events happening across Smethwick and Barewood, with performances by the UK's leading professional puppetry theatre companies. Families will love After the Rain by Sabotage Theatre, with gentle storytelling, singing snails and lots of messy puddles. There's a slapstick children's puppet show, The Librarian, and a new take on The Three Little Pigs from Noisy Oyster. The Stars in the Sky is an adventure romp through the wild beasts of the stars, whilst Up Jump the Crab is a charming puppet show in miniature, showing a day at sea with a real Cromer crab fisherman of North Norfolk. Be sure to head to Worley Woods on February the 19th to meet Charlie, the dragon keeper, who will be roaming around with his pet dragons. Fans of myth and fairy tale will also enjoy the classic tale of the elves and the shoemaker. Puppets are not just for kids. This year there's a puppet making workshop for grown-ups from Tap Vision in 1,000 Trades of the Park and an evening of song and stories inspired by the canals from the Three Idle Women. Artists and storytellers Bronia Evers and Peter Stevenson present a special exhibition at Thimble Mill Library showing her beautifully crafted cranky scrolls, a unique storytelling device that will captivate visitors. New for 2026 is the first Smethwick Puppetry Festival Scratch Night, giving audiences a chance to see extracts of brand new work from emerging and established puppetry artists. Thanks to the generous support of the Players of People's Postcode Lottery, Arts Council England and Sandwell Council, this year's festival is entirely pay what you can. Samwell Puppetry Festival will take place in community venues across Smethwick and Barewood, including the Dorothy Park Centre, Smethwick Library and Thimble Mill Library. Genevieve Say from Black Country Touring comments, "We're delighted to welcome people to the third Smethwick Puppetry Festival, which continues to grow in scale, ambition and reputation across Smethwick and the wider Black Country. What began as a small pilot has quickly become a much-loved part of half term, bringing families, children and communities together. For information and tickets, visit bctouring.org.uk/puppet. Buyer discovers items were his own stolen tools. A man has been arrested and tens of thousands of pounds worth of stolen power tools recovered following a police operation in the Black Country. Officers were called to an address in Smethwick on Friday afternoon after a man who had arranged to buy power tools online discovered the items being offered for sale were in fact his own, stolen from his van the week before. The discovery was made when the victim attended the address to collect the tools, prompting police to attend. Officers from the Wensbury neighbourhood team searched the property and recovered a large quantity of power tools, estimated to be worth between £50,000 and £100,000. A 49-year-old man was arrested at the scene on suspicion of handling stolen goods. Police said he remained in police custody as inquiries continued. A West Midlands police spokesman said, "We know the impact of vehicle crime on our communities, on daily lives and livelihoods, and we'll always look to identify and detain anyone involved in offences." Reducing vehicle crime is a top priority for the force. Take important steps to make sure your van, car or bike is left secure. Simply trying your vehicle's door handle or checking your alarm is on can deter criminals. Unions blame a lack of staff for problems. The Communications Workers Union says there have been an emphasis on parcel deliveries in recent months. It is simplistic to say that that is the entire cause of the problem. Mark Harper, Midlands and East Regional Secretary for the Communication Workers Union, the CWU, says recruitment is a major problem. One major bone of contention is that new recruits to the Postal Service are being offered a significantly lower starting rate than existing staff. It's caused major problems, he says. You get people who will start on a Monday and by Thursday or Friday they have left. They are being paid about the minimum wage and they see what people working for Aldi or Lidl are getting paid more and getting a lot less cold and wet. Royal Mail are really struggling to retain staff. They spend a lot of money training them and putting them in uniforms and then after a few days they say, no thanks, it's not for me. While Royal Mail struck a deal with the regulator Ofcom last year to reduce the number of deliveries, CWU Assistant Branch Secretary for Wolverhampton says this has not been agreed with the union and is currently the subject of a dispute. No ceiling in sight for price of gold and silver, says jeweller. An article by Tamlyn Jones. A Black Country jeweller and gold and silver merchant has described the current price of precious metals as astronomical and sees no reason why the large increases will stop anytime soon. Aaron Sheldon, a director of Bojangles in Wensbury, says the price of gold and silver is on an upward trajectory as people look for safer alternatives to the stock markets. The comments came as the price of gold passed £3,628 per ounce last week, a rise from £2,200 a year ago. While silver was trading at around £70.46 per ounce, almost three times higher than a year ago, at £24.82. Mr. Sheldon said, between 2020 and 2025, gold doubled in price, and now it has gone up another 63% over the past year, while silver has gone up 182%. They have gone absolutely astronomical. There is a deep uncertainty with the current political climate, which is a major issue at the moment, but it is not all necessarily related to Donald Trump, as this rise has been happening ever since COVID. It's more to do with inflation and the cost of living, and gold tends to be a counterbalance to the rate of inflation. The war in Ukraine has also been a big instigator, and also the war in Israel, but now with Trump bringing in tariffs, that is what has started this second surge. Mr. Sheldon said both gold and silver prices had risen by 5% each just recently. Asked whether those rises had to stop, he said, "I would have said that 3 years ago, but look where we are now. I have said every year that this needs to calm down, but it is not doing that. And a lot of analysts and people like myself were more worried about what was ahead. At the back end of last year, the whole silver industry just jammed for about 6 weeks. There was no actual silver available. Now there's panic buying of silver, which is just surging the price because people are seeing how scarce these tangible assets are becoming." Previously based in the Birmingham's famous jewellery quarter, Bojangles now trades from a store in Wensbury Marketplace, which buys and sells silver, jewellery, watches and gold.
Welcome back to the Express and Star Pub Quiz. Question 1. News. Which actor has said it is unlikely he will return in the next instalment of the Paddington film franchise? Question 2. Which judge of the Great British Bake Off has announced they are stepping down? Question 3. Sport. Who was the top try scorer at the 2025 Women's Rugby World Cup? Question 4. How many times did Andy Murray reach the Australian Open final? Question 5. Remember when? The British government banned embroidery on women's underwear and nightwear. Salvador Dali published his autobiography. Comedian Billy Connolly was born. And Walt Disney had another cinematic hit with Bambi. Question 6. Lionel Richie had a UK number one single with Hello. Rob Reiner's This Is Spinal Tap was released. The boat race was postponed for a day after Cambridge's boat was damaged and actress Diana Dawes died. Question 7. Who am I? A politician. I was born in Bath in 1947. I entered Parliament in 1987 as a Conservative MP. I famously accused my political boss, Michael Howard, of having something of a night about him. I have appeared on Strictly Come Dancing and hosted the game show Cleverdix. Question 8. A soprano, I was born in Germany in 1760. I was praised for the precision and clarity of my voice. I married the actor Joseph Lang in 1780, and 2 years later, my sister, Constance, married Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, who had expressed an interest in marrying me. Question 9. Maths impossible puzzles. That's quite a family, said Alan. How old are you? Here's a teaser for you, Greg chuckled. There are 5 of us boys spaced evenly 2 years apart, and I'm the oldest. I'm 1.5 times as old as my youngest brother. How old am I? And question 10. Donuts and eclairs, that's fine for the party. You must have got about 50 in all. Nancy shook her head. Oh, not that many. But I got all that they had. I got as many of each as its price in pence. And the lot came to as many pounds as the number of eclairs and as many pence as the number of doughnuts. How many of each? How's this week's quiz knowledge? Click to the answers to find out.
Some audio described TV programmes for the next week along with radio programme highlights from Talking News Federation. Search for publications TNF Soundings to hear these directly on their website.
TNF Soundings.
Now for the audio described television programmes for the week beginning Saturday the 31st of January 2026 and ending Friday the 6th of February. Written by John and read by Chris. Saturday the 31st. How about a fun start to the week? Sean and the flock set out to find the farmer who is lost in the city. Find out how they get on in Sean the Sheep, the movie, at 2:10 on BBC One this afternoon. There's lots of money around at 4:30 in Ant and Dec's Limitless Win on ITV One. Or you could, in your mind, spend that money on a new home in New Zealand with Phil Spencer as your guide. New Zealand's Best Homes with Phil Spencer is on Channel 4 at 4:45. The remaining 6 performers take to the stage as the panel tries to guess the identity of the famous voices in The Masked Singer on ITV One at 7. Siobhan struggles to pick up the pieces and Dylan decides to tell the truth in Casualty on BBC One at 8:30. As Dan's crisis deepens, his actions threaten his entire future. The penultimate part of Waiting for the Out
is on BBC One at 9:20. A black bear stumbles across an abandoned stash of cocaine. When it eats some, the bear is sent on a violent rampage, endangering hikers, rangers, drug dealers, and nurse Sari and her daughter, who has skipped school to spend a day in the woods. The film Cocaine Bear is on Channel 4 at 9:30. Although not audio described, Match of the Day is on BBC One at 10:25. On to Sunday, the 1st of February. More politicians are put under the spotlight on BBC One at 9 a.m. in Sunday with Laura Koonsberg. Mary joins a bakery team tackling the job of feeding Liverpool fans going to Anfield. Mary Burry, Love to Cook, is on BBC One at 11:30 this morning. Legend sparks controversy in a no-holds-barred Hang Tough. Gladiators is on BBC One at 4:40. The Winter Olympics start at the end of this week, more later, but you can get in the mood with a film based on a true story. Athletes gather in Calgary for the 1988 Winter Olympics, but it's one fearless British ski jumper who makes the headlines. Eddie the Eagle is on BBC Two at 6:20. Sister Catherine is distraught when a newborn is snatched from the maternity home. Call the Midwife is on BBC One at 8. Lots of choice at 9, starting with the final part of The Night Manager on BBC One. The second and final part of Confessions of a Killer, continuing the story of Colin Howell, who confessed to killing his wife and her lover. It's on BBC Two at 9. And there's a new series at 9. If you do well on Only Connect and the 1% Club, this could be for you. The idea is to uncover people who have genius-level IQs by challenging them with a series of clever games and puzzles. There's a warm vibe to it all. What comes over is, however smart they are, panic and self-doubt can dim even the brightest light. Secret Genius is on Channel 4 at 9. Now a look at programmes that are on at the same time each weekday. The following are on BBC One. Rip Off Britain Holidays at 10:45. Homes Under the Hammer at 11:15. Bargain Hunt at 12:15. Lost and Found in the Lakes at 2 p.m. but not on Friday. Escape to the Country at 3 p.m. but at 2:45 on Friday. Now other channels. Dickinson's Real Deal, 2 p.m. on ITV1. Clive Myrie's African Adventure, 6:30 p.m. on BBC Two, but not on Friday. But there's the final episode at 7 on Thursday. Two episodes of Heartbeat on ITV3, starting at 5:50 and 6:55. The soaps are on their usual channels at their usual times. Back to the weekdays, starting with Monday the 2nd. The chef revives some thrifty ideas as he prepares beef and potato pasties and uses the microwave to save energy making gnocchi. Jamie's Feasts for a Fiver is on Channel 4 at 8. It's brain-teasing time of the week with Mastermind and University Challenge on BBC Two at 7:30 and 8:30 respectively. There's a new series starting tonight. The team relocate to Birmingham. Nikki and Jack hunt a suspect who later claims responsibility for a murder that crypt a nation. Silent Witness on BBC One at 9. In the final part, with the police searching for Declan, a bombshell threatens Joe and Pat's investigation into Mackie. After the Flood concludes at 9 on ITV1. How did you get on with last night's Secret Genius? Well, there's another set of contestants with new challenges at 9 on Channel 4. Would you like to go to Mars? That's what a young Brian Cox wanted to do. So he wrote to NASA to get some images, which they sent. He is now a physicist and a professor, and tonight he realises that dream by being invited behind the scenes at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab for the 2020 mission to Mars. Brian Cox, 7 days on Mars, is on BBC4 at 10 tonight. On to Tuesday the 3rd. The chef travels to one of Australia's most important food bowls, which has been shaped by irrigation and migration. Rick Stein's Australia is on BBC2 at 7. ITV1 is showing the football match between Arsenal and Chelsea, starting at 7:30. It's not audio described, but hopefully the commentary will help you understand how the match is progressing. It seems a long way off, but lawnmower season will come round, and tonight Paddy and Cherry are looking at lawns and the cutting of them. Paddy visits the Hayter factory in Herefordshire, while Cherry sees how the pitch is prepared at Wembley Stadium. Inside the Factory is on BBC One at 8. The second part of this week's Silent Witness is on at BBC One at 9. When the ship docks in Malta, the brothers go on the hunt around the capital, but things turn deadly when their eldest sibling is found dead. The Good Ship Murder is on Channel 5 at 9. Now Wednesday the 4th. The chef heads for his favourite part of Australia. Known as the Sapphire Coast, Rick investigates why it has this name. Rick Stein's Australia on BBC Two at 7. A keyboard once owned by the Stranglers musician Dave Greenfield, a pair of 50-year-old platform shoes, and the somewhat dented 1965 Tulip Rally Trophy are all in need of help from the repair shop on BBC One at 8. Again, lots of choice at 9. On BBC One, Can You Keep a Secret? William visits a drug dealer when he runs out of medication. On BBC Two, Laura Koonsberg examines whether Nigel Farage's party, Reform UK, is ready for government. Reform, Ready to Rule, is on BBC Two. And a member of a rock band is found dead in tonight's Grantchester on ITV One at 9. After being dismissed from MI5, Dom and Kay go their separate ways. Which way is explained in Black Ops on BBC One at 9:30. The charismatic funeral director, Hayley, helps families make their personal farewells with warmth, humour and honesty. The Fabulous Funeral Parlour is on Channel 4 at 10. Thursday the 5th. ITV1 is showing rugby tonight, featuring the Six Nations match between France and Ireland. Again, unfortunately, it's not audio described, but the commentary should help. It starts at 7:30. Skincare made from rescued food, a gadget to keep golf balls clean, an app that helps users overpay their mortgage, and a seasoning bowl to spice up your cooking are all looking for investment in the Dragon's Den at BBC One at 8. It's an emotional roller coaster for Lauren as she and her partner remodel the home she inherited from her grandparents. George Clark's Building Homes is on Channel 4 at 8. In the second part, the candidates are challenged to create a children's story and audiobook. One team turns to toilet humour, the other to zebra theme, but who will have the most successful fairy tale? The Apprentice is on BBC One at 9. This is followed at 10 on BBC Two in The Apprentice Unfinished Business, with a review of the second task and an interview with the second person to leave the boardroom. And finally, Friday the 6th. As I said earlier, the Winter Olympics start this week. Tonight, in fact, with the opening ceremony starting at 6:30. Unfortunately, it's not audio described, but the commentary should give you a good idea of what's going on. Amanda and Alan's Greek Job concludes tonight with two episodes at 7:30 and 8 o'clock. They create a mythological reading room and a high-tech bathroom at 7:30, and then build a barbecue out of stone, which they use to throw a leaving party. Both episodes are on BBC One. What if the Russians prevail in Ukraine? This two-part series follows how NATO is getting ready to defend territory if the Russians were to succeed. Frontline, Our Soldiers Facing Putin, is on Channel 4 at 8. An exclusive couples retreat turns deadly when the therapist is drowned at sea. But finger marks on the victim's neck lead Mervyn to suspect foul play. Death in Paradise is on BBC One at 9. Or you could end the week reviewing this week's programmes with Gogglebox, where the armchair critics share their opinions on what they've been watching. Find out if you agree on Channel 4 at 9. We hope you find something of interest in this week's suggestions.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, January 31st. And to mark the 10th anniversary of the death of Terry Wogan, a rerun of With Great Pleasure, in which he discusses his favourite pieces of poetry and prose. 7:30 in the morning or 12:30 at lunchtime, Radio 4 Extra on Saturday. If you're a tennis fan, you'll be keen to tune in to the Women's Australian Open Tennis Final from Melbourne. The match starts at 8:30 in the morning, Radio 5 Live. Timothy Spall stars as artist Francis Bacon in a play based on the 2022 memoir by London artist James Birch about a 1980s exhibition of the artist's work in Moscow, the first major Western artist to have a solo exhibition in the Soviet Union. Bacon in Moscow, 3 o'clock Saturday afternoon, Radio 4. Opera on 3 brings us a New York Metropolitan Opera House performance of Richard Strauss's Arabella. Set in 1860s Vienna, the plot revolves around the Waldner family's attempts to keep up appearances as a member of the Austrian gentry. Tune in to Radio 3, 6 o'clock, Saturday night. Sunday, February 1st, Desert Island Discs Revisited brings us a 2012 edition of Terry Wogan discussing his favourite discs. At a choice of times on Radio 4 Extra at 6 in the morning, 11 a.m. or 5 p.m. It's the men's final of the Australian Tennis Open as well on Sunday. Tune in to Radio 5 Live from 8:30 in the morning for all the action. Lon Laverne's guest this week on Desert Island Discs is the astronomer, Royal Professor Michelle Doughty. 10 o'clock, Radio 4. Well, drama on 4 is Walden. Paul Farley's dramatisation of Henry David Thoreau's account of his time living in the cabin in the woods next to Walden Ponds in Massachusetts, striving to live in tune with nature. Walden is the drama on Radio 4 at 3 o'clock. And in the 1930s, a group of researchers asked the residents of Bolton what made them happy. So to discover whether the town still holds the secret to happiness, Catherine Longworth visits people who live in the same properties as the original correspondents in the survey. Bolton, the happiest town on earth, 7:15, Sunday night, Radio 4. On to programmes then, and the broadcast each weekday at the same time, same radio station. So each day, Monday to Friday, same time, same radio station. Patricia Routledge and Prunella Scales star as two mature ladies sharing a sometimes rocky relationship through their correspondence in the very funny Ladies of Letters Log On. Choice of times each weekday on Radio 4 Extra, 8:45 in the morning, 1:45 or 7:45 p.m. Book of the Week is Constable's Year by Susan Owens, the story of how artist John Constable's life and art were shaped by his love for his native Suffolk and the natural world. 11:45 every morning on Radio 4. In 1986, Sri Lankan man Viraj Mendis begged for sanctuary in the Church of the Ascension in Hume, Greater Manchester, fearing he could be killed if sent back to his home country. Father John Methrin and a devoted group sheltered and protected him. The series explores how events unfolded. Sanctuary, an act of defiance, 1:45 each weekday on Radio 4, Monday to Friday this week. Composer of the Week is Scottish composer, pianist, organist and conductor Eric Chisholm. The series begins with Chisholm's early years in Glasgow as he discovers the piano and the lure of folk melody. Radio 3, Composer of the Week, 4 o'clock all week. You probably haven't heard of composer Granville Bantock, but in the early 20th century he was a major star of the music world. Ian Sampson examines five now-forgotten former major cultural figures in the essay almost famous, starting with Granville Bantock, Disappearing Giant, 9:45 p.m. each weeknight on Radio 3 this week. And The White Lady of Morecambe, Jen Ashworth's ghostly tale set in the near future, is read by Julie Heshmanhoe, each weeknight, Radio 4, for Book of Bedtime at 10:45 p.m. Back to some of the individual programmes then to listen to through the week, starting with Monday, February 2nd. The series An American Journey continues, and this week's episode explores how justice has been understood by different generations of Americans. James Naughtie visits Alabama to hear about the civil rights movement, and he talks to Texans on both sides of the abortion debate. An American Journey, 11 a.m, Radio 4, Monday morning. And Just a Minute returns with Sue Perkins in the chair. Tonight's subjects include Singing in the Shower and Alan Bennett. 6:30 p.m, Radio 4, on Monday. Tuesday, February 3rd, there's a new series of This Thing of Darkness, the drama starring Lilita Chakrabarty as Dr. Alex Bridges, an expert forensic psychiatrist who assesses and treats perpetrators of serious crime. Radio 4, Tuesday afternoon, 2:15. In Touch with Peter White has the latest news for the blind and partially sighted, 8:45 p.m. on Radio 4 on Tuesday. Well, afterwards, followed by Crossing Continents, in which Divya Arya reports on how sport is helping young women in India, or some of them, to avoid child marriage and allowing them to forge an identity for themselves. Crossing Continents follows In Touch on Radio 4 at 9 p.m. Wednesday, February 4th. Sideways, a new series, looks at ideas that shape individual lives, starting with an episode which examines whether belief in miracles can be compatible with scientific thinking. The excellent Matthew Syed hears the story of a neuroscientist who believes that his recovery from an inoperable tumour is evidence of divine intervention. Sideways is on Radio 4 at 9 o'clock on Wednesday morning. Or if you miss it, I'm sure it's available on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcasts from as well. Also on Wednesday, drama on Radio 4, Deacon, A Reckoning, a supernatural drama in which widower James Persad feels lost without his wife. Can enigmatic Deacon help? 2:15, Radio 4 for drama, Deacon, A Reckoning. Thursday, February 5th, A Wild Woman of the North, a drama by Esther Wilson. In the wake of a tragedy, a family moved to the countryside in a bid to heal through a new way of life which is closer to nature. 2:15 for drama, on Radio 4, Wild Woman of the North. It's followed by Claire Balding's Ramblings, and this week Claire joins Ian Tisdale for a walk in the Lake District. He and his wife Catherine are on a mission to climb all 214 Wainwright Fells as part of their terminal illness project, which they started after Ian was diagnosed with incurable bowel cancer. Ramblings, 3 o'clock, Radio 4, Thursday afternoon. Finally, Friday, February 6th, and the Nordic thriller Limelight, Wolf Valley, continues. As new revelations emerge, Lena and Axel find disturbing evidence of ancient rituals, far-right symbols and shadowy connections, leading to a shocking discovery in a remote cabin. 2:15, Friday afternoon, Radio 4. And as we end the week, the radio recommendations anyway, Friday night is Music Night, and John Andrews conducts the BBC Concert Orchestra and the West Green Opera Chorus, joined by Albanian soprano Emanu Jaho and London-born tenor Thomas Elwin, in a concert of popular arias, including those by Verdi and Donizetti. The concert starts at 7:30 on Radio 3. That's it. Thank you to Angela for the highlights this week. May I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable one of radio listening.
TNS Soundings.
Here are the answers for this week's quiz. Question 1. News. Which actor has said it is unlikely he will return in the next instalment of the Paddington film franchise? Hugh Bonneville. Question 2. Which judge of the Great British Bake Off has announced they are stepping down? Dame Prue Leith. Question 3. Sport. Who was the top try scorer at the 2025 Women's Rugby World Cup? Braxton Sorensen McGee. Question 4. How many times did Andy Murray reach the Australian Open final? Five. Question 5. Remember when? The British government banned embroidery on women's underwear and nightwear. Salvador Dali published his autobiography. Comedian Billy Connolly was born, and Walt Disney had another cinematic hit with Bambi. Question 6. Lionel Richie had a UK number one single with Hello. Rob Reiner's This Is Spinal Tap was released. The boat race was postponed for a day after Cambridge's boat was damaged and actress Diana Dawes died. Question 7. Who am I? A politician. I was born in Bath in 1947. I entered Parliament in 1987 as a Conservative MP. I famously accused my political boss, Michael Howard, of having something of a knight about him. I have appeared on Strictly Come Dancing and hosted the game show Cleverdix. I am Anne Widdicombe. Question 8. A soprano, I was born in Germany in 1760. I was praised for the precision and clarity of my voice. I married the actor Joseph Lang in 1780, and 2 years later, my sister, Constance, married Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, who had expressed an interest in marrying me. I am Maria Aloysia Weber Lang. Question 9. Maths Impossible Puzzles. That's quite a family, said Alan. How old are you? Here's a teaser for you, Greg chuckled. There are 5 of us boys spaced evenly 2 years apart, and I'm the oldest. I'm 1.5 times as old as my youngest brother. How old am I? I am 24 years old. And question 10. Donuts and eclairs. That's fine for the party. You must have got about 50 in all. Nancy shook her head. Oh, not that many. But I got all that they had. I got as many of each as its price in pence. And the lot came to as many pounds as the number of eclairs and as many pence as the number of donuts. How many of each? Twelve eclairs and 33 donuts. Thanks for joining me in this week's quiz. I'm Sarah Ann, and I'll be back next time. Bye!
Hi, this is Kate and I'm reading you some articles from the Express and Star, dated the 27th of January. Being an active grandparent can slow your mental decline. Days out, overnight stays and caring for them when they're ill are all good for you. Being a grandparent is good for your brain and may stave off the decline in thinking skills and memory, researchers suggested. A new study on adults in England found grandparents who provided care for their grandchildren tended to show better cognitive function than those who did not. Grandmothers in particular, whose studies suggest provide more care than grandfathers, showed a slight slowing in cognitive decline. In the English Longitudinal Study of Ageing, the acronym is ELSA, is examining the health, social and well-being, as well as economic circumstances of people aged 50 and over. Researchers writing in the Journal of Psychology and Ageing used ELSA data from 2,887 grandparents. The survey asked whether people had provided care for grandchildren at any point in the last year and how often. Grandparents also gave details of the kind of care that they provided, such as having grandchildren overnight, caring for them when they were ill, playing with them or taking them places, helping with homework, driving grandchildren to school and activities, and preparing meals. A verbal fluency test asked people to name as many animals as possible within 1 minute. For memory, people were asked to recall 10 words immediately and then again after 5 minutes. Overall, the study found that grandparents who provided childcare scored higher on the tests of both memory and verbal fluency compared to those who did not, regardless of the amount of care given. Grandmothers providing care also showed less cognitive decline over time. The research also found that those grandparents with initially higher cognitive levels were more engaged in specific activities with their grandchildren, such as assisting with homework. Murder-accused mum misses court hearings. The judge in the trial of a mother accused of killing a baby girl in West Bromwich was left apologising to juries after she failed to arrive 3 days in a row. Zara Arsalan, 31, also known as Sharon Deep Talwandi, is standing trial at Coventry Crown Court accused of murdering baby Harleen Baines on July the 23rd, 2020. The defendant, who is in custody on remand, failed to arrive for the third time yesterday, and as a result, the proceedings have been halted temporarily. Man dies after a car strikes M6 barrier. A man aged in his 50s has died on the M6 after a car struck a barrier. It comes after a silver Porsche 911 Carrera hit a barrier near Junction 7 at Great Bar and Junction 6 for Birmingham at around 12:15 a.m. yesterday. Emergency services attended and discovered the man, who was confirmed dead at the scene. West Midlands Police have said at this stage they don't believe that any other vehicle was involved in the fatal collision. Hospice Boost will support upgrades, but not services. Cash aimed at repairs, improved rooms, more outdoor spaces and IT systems. More than £3.4 million in funding has been distributed to hospices across the Midlands. The region has received a total of £3,401,243 in hospice funding, with 14 of these being in the West Midlands. The cash injection comes after the Minister for State confirmed that hospices across England will receive more capital funding to support essential upgrades. The government announced that it will provide an extra £25 million in capital funding for 158 adult and children hospices across England. This money is now being allocated to individual hospices by Hospice UK. And they will help to fund urgent building repairs, better facilities and patient rooms, new outdoor spaces and improved IT equipment. The cash injection has been welcomed, but can only be used on essential improvements and not on staff costs. Compton Care's CEO, Rachel Overfield, said, "We're grateful for it and it definitely helps, but on its own, it certainly doesn't help to keep all of our services going. The money we receive can only be spent on buildings, equipment and technology and cannot be spent on staff, which means it doesn't really help the underlying financial challenges that the hospices face. We use the funds to build a patient app, to replace some IT kit and buy some new furniture. We're also installing a new patient call system on the ward, which acts as a fall prevention system. Quite a lot has been spent on the grounds and we've now got solar panels and this latest pot of money is going to replace our boilers." Dr. Richard Salisbury, Chief Executive at Catherine House Hospice Stafford, said the investment will allow us to modernise our IT systems, including introducing a new electronic prescribing system. And this article is supported by a photograph of Compton Care. They have to raise £12 million every year just to stand still, and is helped by numerous fundraising events and ambassadors. Supporters and ambassadors have just launched Cycle for Compton, which takes place in May. And then it's also got a photograph of the Panto star Chico with Mary Stevens Hospice CEO and matron Claire Towns and the director of funding, Amanda Bowen. And Acorns Children's Hospital has received the largest allocation in the region. And in this article, it does break down the 14 West Midlands hospices and how much they will get. So Acorns Children Hospital will get £402,797. Compton Care will get £200,000. Hope House Children's Hospice will get £157,086. Catherine House Hospice will get £97,868. Kemp Hospice, £24,012. Mary Ann Evans Hospital, £37,430. Mary Stevens Hospital is £30,000. Severn Hospital, £299,078. St Giles Hospice, £249,803. St Michael's Hospice, £169,739. St Richard's Hospice, £172,188. The Myton Hospice is £227,554. The Shakespeare Hospice, £35,338. And Zoe's Place Baby Hospice, £108,964. On-duty train station security guard jailed for sexual assault. We will stop at nothing to ensure that sexual predators are removed from communities. A Samwell train station security guard who targeted a 14-year-old girl while on duty has been jailed. Amar Mohammed, aged 35, of Shireland Road, Smethwick, has been jailed for the sexual assault of a teenage girl following an investigation by the British Transport Police. While on duty on November the 14th, 2021, Mohammed approached a 14-year-old girl at Worcester Shrub Hill railway station wearing a high-vis vest before asking her where she was travelling to. He then walked her to the platform as the train was due to arrive before heading into an office in the station. Short while later, he invited her into the office as a warm place to stay while she waited for her train. As she approached the room, Mohammed turned off the room's lights, and inside the office, Mohammed forced himself upon the teenager and sexually assaulted her. She managed to get away from him and returned to the platform to board her train. He then emerged from the office and waved at her as the service left the train station. The victim, who suffered bruisings from the attack, reported Mohammed's actions to her family, who then called the police. He was arrested the same evening, and an extensive investigation led by the BTP detectives resulted in multiple charges being brought against him. Specialist support was provided to the victim throughout the investigation, and as the case progressed through the courts, Mohammed failed to appear for a subsequent court hearing and had to be rearrested in his home in March 2023. Mohammed was found guilty of 2 counts of sexual assault and is sentenced to 3 years and 8 months in prison. He was also given an indefinite sexual harm prevention order, SHPO, and will remain on the sex offenders register for life. The British Transport Police Detective Constable Tim Friend praised the teenage victim for her bravery in reporting the incident. He said, "Amar Mohammed used his trusted position as a station security guard to groom a teenage girl and subject her to a deplorable sexual assault. His attack was so forceful that it left the victim with physical injuries and will no doubt have a lasting impact on her psychologically. It's down to her bravery in reporting him to the police and determination to stick with the process as it progressed through the courts that we've been able to bring a truly vile man to justice. He'll stop at nothing to ensure sexual predators like Mohammed are removed from our communities and put behind bars where they belong." And this article is supported by a photograph of Amar Mohammed.
Albion Match Report. Chris Metham scored a 95th minute equaliser at Derby to ensure West Bromwich Albion avoided equaling a club record 11th straight league defeat on the road. Before the defender salvaged a point in stoppage time, the visitors were seemingly on their way to matching a miserable run that dated back more than 134 years. It was a fumble from debutant Baggies goalkeeper Max O'Leary that allowed Derby striker Patrick Adjumang to prod the hosts ahead in the first half with a goal that, until the late drama, appeared to be sending the Rams into the Championship playoff places. But Methven forced home a header from a corner to deny the home side and earn boss Eric Ramsey his first point as West Brom boss after back-to-back defeats to start his tenure. When West Brom last won away from home this season, victory at Norwich City on the 1st of October, put them fourth in the table under Ryan Mason. The dismal run that followed, which was headlined by 10 defeats away from home, cost Mason his job in early January, leaving his replacement Ramsey faced with the prospect of overseeing a record-equalling league defeat in what was his first match away from home. Both sides made five changes for the game, with goalkeeper Jacob Widdle-Zetterson among those coming in for the Rams after illness ruled him out of Tuesday's win at Charlton. The Baggies' 5-0 home thrashing by Norwich the same night prompted an overhaul for the trip across the Midlands, which included O'Leary being given his debut in goal just a day after joining from Bristol City. It would become a forgettable first appearance from the 29-year-old, whose failure to deal with a free kick from Callum Elder saw him drop the ball in front of United States international Adjumung to pounce on. The 44th-minute goal came from Derby's only effort on goal after an underwhelming first half in which Jason Malumbi tested Zetterson at the other end before George Campbell crashed a header just wide. Both sides carved out opportunities inside the 90 minutes, with the best of them put well wide by Derby's Ben Brereton-Diaz after linking up with Adjumang's on a quick counter-attack. West Brom piled forward in search of an equaliser, and it was an effort from Josh Imadja that squirmed just wide in stoppage time that eventually led to the leveller. From the ensuing corner, Mepham's header at the back post proved too powerful for Zetterstrom to stop from crossing the line. While West Brom managed to ease their woes away from home by collecting a much-needed point at Pride Park, the trip may prove costly after Carlin Grant went off early with an apparent hamstring injury, while Christian Bielik's night was ended by a shoulder problem. Eric Ramsey said, "We ultimately deserved what we got. I felt it was a controlled performance and the exact performance we needed tonight. It wasn't spectacular, but it put right a lot of the wrongs from the previous game. We wanted control defensively and we restricted the opposition. We were very strong in that department and carried our own threat. I can see very clearly how this team will and needs to be competitive, and that was the start point."
TNF Soundings.
This is Amanda with an article written by Fiona. Hold on to your hats. We're about to take a trip around the world to explore how technology and simple human determination are making life easier for people with visual impairment. We will travel to Colorado, Mumbai, Chichester, and finally into outer space. At a research university in Colorado named the School of Minds, an innovative new device is helping people who are blind or who have low vision to feel facial expressions. The assistive technology is a wristband and a pair of glasses that use computer vision to translate facial expressions into vibrations on the wearer's wrist. This technology has been named Hapware, and it recreates the sensation of nonverbal cues through vibrations. For example, a smile feels like an upward U-shape pattern on the wrist, while a wave creates a side-to-side motion. Hapware co-founder and chief technology officer Brian Duarte, PhD, who lost his sight at age 18, said he was amazed by the accuracy and intuitiveness of feedback from the wristband. In tests, within just 90 seconds of wearing the device, volunteers could identify 7 nonverbal cues with 95% accuracy. One of the first users said, When I began to feel the vibration sets and was able to interpret their meaning, it began to restore a long-lost depth of everyday communication. Hapware's device is currently being tested by potential users and is expected to launch commercially in early 2026. The company plans to offer the product at a $99 pre-order cost and a small monthly subscription. Let's jet off now to Mumbai, where two Bombay High Court judges came to the rescue of a blind woman who was unfairly excluded from government jobs due to a mistake made while filing her application form. As reported in the Hindustan Times, Shabana Pinjari, 41, had approached the court challenging her exclusion. She had applied to join the provisional select list prepared by the Maharashtra Public Service Commission for the posts of clerk cum typist in various state establishments. She complained that, due to an error, she was denied a fair opportunity and was compelled to opt for an unreserved post meant for open category candidates. When she complained about the error, the Maharashtra Public Service Commission gave her an opportunity to change her application. However, instead of allowing her to benefit from all the available options, she was only allowed to opt for the unreserved post of a clerk cum typist. Justices M.S. Karnik and N.R. Borkar held that under the Persons with Disabilities Act, state government was obliged to provide additional support to persons with disabilities to facilitate their participation in society. Following the hearing, the court directed the Maharashtra Public Service Commission to recommend Ms. Pinjari for the first available post for 100% visually impaired candidates. Back now to Chichester, where we land on the social media platform of blind footballer Toby Addison. Toby, 24, lost his sight suddenly at the age of 13 and has 4% vision. As a skilled footballer for West Brom and the England squad, Toby has a passion for fitness and popularising blind football. Acknowledging that many people may not be able to imagine what it's like living with visual impairment, he opened up his social media platform to invite his followers to ask him any questions, and they did. From the humorous, for example, "How do you know if your socks are on the correct foot?" Toby's answer, "I didn't know socks have a correct foot." To the factual, such as, "How do you vision yourself, as a kid or something completely different?" Toby's answer, "I picture myself how I looked at 15, before I went fully blind." And the technical, "When paying for something and you use your card, how do you know they're not overcharging you?" Toby's answer, "I don't, lol, just have to trust people." Toby documents his blind football journey online and hopes one day he will compete in the Paralympics and Football World Cup. And now we travel into outer space. All these welcome stories about Earth-based support for people with visual impairment should come as a relief to astronauts returning from extended stays on the International Space Station, ISS. Approximately 70% of astronauts on long-duration missions report vision problems. NASA scientists are investigating why the weightless environment of space affects sight and why these vision changes may be permanent. This condition, called spaceflight-associated neuroocular syndrome, SANS, or SANS, is a major concern for long-term space travel. Unlike other space-related issues, like motion sickness or muscle loss, which improve quickly on Earth, SANS can cause lasting vision damage. The problem stems from microgravity, where the absence of gravity causes bodily fluids to shift upward, leading to facial swelling and increased pressure inside the skull. This pressure can flatten the eyeball's shape and swell the optic nerve, altering vision. Dr. Michael Roberts, NASA's lead vision researcher, emphasized the stakes, saying, "With Mars missions potentially lasting 2 to 3 years, addressing SANS is critical."
TNF Soundings. TNF Soundings.
Hello, my name is Lindsay. I started producing topical items during lockdown to keep my neighbours entertained. All the recordings are made inside my cosy cabin for that extra sense of calm. And naturally enough, I called them cabin conversations. I hope you enjoy them. Cabin conversations about World Radio Day. This awareness day is surprisingly recent, only being formally endorsed by UNESCO in 2011, and the 13th of February specifically chosen to mark the founding of the United Nations Radio back in 1946. Since then, World Radio Day has gained global recognition, with broadcasters, listeners, journalists, and communities coming together to highlight radio's contributions across cultures and continents. A convenient, adaptable medium for education, connection, and public safety, particularly in the most remote corners of the earth. And despite the prominence of evolving AI and digital technologies today, the need for person-to-person trust and familiarity over the airwaves remains. Actually, sound waves, electromagnetic waves, and alternating currents were all quantified by German physicist Heinrich Rudolf Hertz in 1888. He defined the unit of frequency as 1 hertz equaling 1 event per second. For example, the average frequency of the human voice is around 1,000 hertz, or 1 kilohertz. This Hertz scale advanced the sciences of audio engineering and communication. So much so that Guglielmo Marconi, an Italian electrical engineer and inventor, born of an Irish mother and Italian father, went on to create the first practical radio signal system in 1896 and was the first to transmit wireless communication signals across the Atlantic Ocean in 1901, hailed as a landmark achievement. Perhaps the most significant improvement in portable radio development during the 20th century should be credited to Trevor Graham Bayliss, an English inventor best known for the Free Play wind-up radio marketed from 1994. This was a game-changer for remote and electricity-deficient areas of the world, using a manual winding handle to power the unit and making it a key device for broadcasting information during times of infrastructure crisis due to conflict, climate change, disease control, or other events. There are several broadcast frequencies commonly used today. The main types are AM, which stands for amplitude modulation, meaning these radio waves travel long distances with variable strength within Earth's ionosphere and often suffer from crackling due to atmospheric electrical static. Whereas FM stands for frequency modulation and transmits at higher frequencies, piercing the Earth's ionosphere, sending signals into space. Yet on the ground, the radio waves have shorter travel distances, albeit clearer audio signals. Lastly, there is DAB, or digital audio broadcasting, enabling digital data to be transmitted as opposed to analog signals. This supports multiple radio stations broadcasting on a single frequency with multiple channels. This format is used by over 55 countries and especially popular in Europe, Australia, and parts of Africa. In the UK, there are many different forms of radio stations. The British Broadcasting Company, the BBC, takes front stage with BBC Radio 2 Top of the Poles, with 13,318,000 listeners. To independent stations like Great Hits Radio, with 7,525,000. Others include the British Forces Broadcasting Service, covering all those serving in the military and their families, through to hospitals, prisons, and communities. Also available are temporary restricted licenses for broadcasters who cover mainly seasonal events, sports such as the Wimbledon Tennis Championships or Cowes Boat Race, along with all manner of festivals and even the Scouts' Jamborees. In fact, various stations and radio programmes have contributed greatly to the well-being of listeners. Keeping up with favourite sports was possible with audio-described radio services from 1927. The BBC World Service began in 1932 to track international affairs. The entertainment side, vital for morale in wartime, brought comedy in 1939 with It's That Man Again, shortened to ITMAR. Next came the beloved Desert Island Discs in 1942, providing that all-important escape from everyday life, airing now for nearly 84 years. Speaking of islands, although the Channel Islands and the Isle of Man are not part of the UK, they are served by its national radio stations. Another set of islands with a unique history is the Falklands. Argentina claimed sovereignty over the British-owned islands in 1982, starting a war. All phone and radio network communications were cut off by the invading forces, in a bid to prevent any tactical advantage information reaching London. However, this did not stop two Falkland Islander amateur radio operators from sending crucial information via airwave signals to a fellow radio ham operator in Scotland, who managed to relay details of Argentine troop deployment, bombing raids, radar bases, and other useful activities to British military intelligence headquarters, ensuring the UK triumphed after 10 weeks of fighting. Incidentally, the term radio hams originated from telegraph professionals who saw the amateur radio operators as unskilled or ham-fisted, meaning clumsy, compared to their own highly trained roles. Nonetheless, so valued are these dedicated amateur radio operators that the Red Cross requested 50 volunteers support Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria hit in 2017. Their job? Simply to provide standalone communication services. Considering radio has been in everyday lives now for over a century, there is no other form of communication that can feel so personal to the listener than radio. And as mentioned, in many cases, a lifeline in an ever-changing and unpredictable world. May you always find yourself on a positive wavelength.
TNF Soundings.
Busking for Charity selects SVI for 2026. Live music fundraising will help SVI offer more social activities and days out for members. Sound or visually impaired, SVI is thrilled to have been selected as one of the charities that Busking for Charity and the Busketeers will support in 2026. These popular local fundraisers are musicians, radio personalities and venue owners. The partnership will see a series of live music events and ongoing fundraising activities take place throughout the year, with money raised helping SVI to offer more trips, social opportunities and activities for people living with sight loss across Sandwell. Busking for Charity was founded by Billy Spakebon, Dr. Brian Dakin, a long-standing friend of SVI. Many members will remember Billy from performances at SVI Open meetings, as well as when the Busketeers, Billy and Tim Martin played during the Active 60 Black Country Mon narrow boat trip in 2024. They also appeared at the volunteer celebration event SVI held last year, together with mental health charity Kaleidoscope. The Busketeers' connection with SVI has helped bring this fundraising partnership together. The group was originally set up to support the Sandwell Breast Cancer Unit, which cared for Billy's late wife for more than 12 years. Since then, Busking for Charity has grown organically, expanding its work to support departments at Russell's Hall Hospital and a wide range of local community organisations. To date, the group has donated over £100,000 to more than 30 local causes. Today, Busking for Charity operates as a democratic collective, bringing together performers, radio personalities and venue owners who are committed to giving back to the local community. In 2025 alone, the group raised and distributed £21,000 to six organisations, with similarly ambitious fundraising plans in place for 2026. Sandra, development worker at Sandwell Visually Impaired, said, "We are delighted that the Busketeers have selected SVI to be one of their chosen charities for 2026. Money they raise will enable us to offer more trips out and social activities for our members in the years to come. SVI looks forward to working closely with Busking for Charity and the Busketeers throughout 2026. Thanks to all our volunteers who've read the Express and Star articles for us this week, James, Debbie, Lauren, Sarbjit, Jenny and Kate, along with Sarah Ann doing the quiz and Sue for picking all the articles. Well, have a lovely week, everyone.
To use our talk phone service to listen to Sandwell Talking News or leave us a message, phone 0121 699 6696. If you are using a landline in the 0121 area, then just dial 699 6696.